Hi there, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Murray Musings. It's been quite quiet down at Murray Musings HQ since Wimbledon, but we are back and we are very excited to have a special guest with us, friend of the pod, Dave Samuel, who's been on before. Dave, if you don't already know, Dave is Liam Brody's coach, and he's very in, we get some excellent insights into the game from Dave. So we're really happy to have you here, Dave. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us today. How are you?
Yeah, thanks very much for having me. It's always a pleasure. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So we've got Peter with us as well. I actually have had to mute Peter because there's a little bit of interference in the background, but hopefully if I unmute him now, he'll be able to chat. Peter is on the road. For anyone that follows Peter on Instagram or Twitter, they'll have seen that he's been in Cincinnati for the past 10 days or so he's on his way home, so we do apologize if there's any chat dropping in and out while he is in his car, but I'll unmute him and hopefully he'll be able to speak to us. Peter, can you hear us? No, we can't. Okay, well, Dave, I'm just going to dive right in then, and hopefully if Peter comes back he can. So we're approaching the US Open. I can't believe it. For me, it feels like the Australian Open was just a few weeks ago. But here we are at almost the final slam, final major of the year. I wanted to have a little bit of a chat with you about the first three slams and the sort of, I want three standout matches from you. From the first three slams of the year, if I may put you on the spot, with the exception of a certain Liam Brody versus Casper Ruud, I'd like to speak about that separately later on. But if you could think of a match from each of the slams this year that stood out for you, and just a little reason why, as we look towards the US Open.
I think a match that stands out for me is Novak against in Australia against Enzo Corco. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, he was struggling. Enzo was playing very, very well. It was a match that Novak really kind of had to, you know, win to really get his Australian Open going, I felt. And I think it was kind of in that match that the fire in Novak was kind of lit. Mm-hmm. Where he started to play some better tennis, and I think started to just believe that even though he wasn't physically feeling amazing, that he had it in him to go through the tournament. I think that was second round, wasn't it?
Yeah. I was just trying to think back there because Enzo took a set off of him, didn't he?
That's right. Yeah. And gave him a scare and was playing good tennis. But I felt it was where Novak started to find some form, and by the end of that match, I think he was feeling a lot better about mm-hmm. everything.
Yeah.
And that was almost like the kickstart to his Australian Open.
Yeah, definitely.
So and I thought some really good tennis was played in that match. And I think it's also again an indication of the depth in men's tennis where, you know, you can get a qualifier who's, you know, coming out there and swinging and not really afraid to have a full go. And I think that's a big change in the last sort of 5 years, where the difference between, say, number one in the world and 150 has concertinaed. It's a lot less. And I think the gaps have whilst there are still gaps there, they have narrowed.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to see, you know, we're already seeing more and more kind of upsets, especially from the sort of 5 to 100 range.
Yep.
Obviously, you know, Novak and Alcaraz, you know, that little bit more consistent and really at the top. But I think, you know, even, you know, Tommy Paul took out, obviously, Alcaraz and our own Cam Norrie took out Alcaraz earlier this year. So, you know, I think tennis is getting to a really exciting place where, you know, Novak now has some real competitors.
And
it's not just as clear cut as it was.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, just what you were saying about the qualifier to come out and just give it their all. My heart always sinks a little bit when I see a draw and Andy Murray draws a qualifier, because I am very wary of qualifiers in slams because they're on a winning streak. You know, they're coming into the first round on a winning streak, and they're probably thinking, well, I've got nothing to lose here in this first round match. I've come this far, so why not give it 150%? Look, I can do this. I've got the belief to do it. So
they have three tough matches under their belt, because qualifying is a real battle. It's very hard to do to qualify for a slam.
Yeah.
So they come in on the back of three very good matches. The other thing is the conditions and everything like that, they're very comfortable in them because they've played three matches in them. So yeah, I'd say that a qualifier is always it's a very dangerous draw, especially when you've got an experienced player who's qualified. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes if you get the guys qualified for the first time or second time, they may be a little bit still too excited just to be in the tournament. And it's, you know, all just too kind of new for them. And and that actually is probably often a good draw, because they're just kind of happy to be there first time. But if you get somebody who's, you know, played a number of slams and they qualify, it's very tricky and very awkward for players. So yes, I agree with you. It's a dangerous match.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I mean, all matches are dangerous, but it's especially dangerous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is the thing about tennis. You just never know what's going to happen. You can think this is a clear-cut win for player X because they're the really experienced one. They're in the top five in the world. But you just never know what's going to happen on the day. And, you know, I think that's what makes it really interesting a lot of the time.
Yes, I think, you know, some of the differences is just the ability for a player to bring a base level to the court day in and day out. And that's what's given them the very high ranking.
Mm-hmm.
But on a given day, there's probably, you know, a lot of players that can match their base level. And you know, that's what makes it very, very dangerous. It's, you know, the reason they're higher ranked is because their base level is higher day in and day out.
Yeah.
And the lower ranked player has a lower base level, but what they're able to produce is the same as a really top player can produce. Yeah. They just can't produce it as consistently.
Yeah.
And I think that's where you know, tennis has concertinaed, and it's, you know, there's no real, I mean, sometimes a match turns out easy, but it's actually pretty rare. You know, even if a player wins like 6-3, 6-4, it looks pretty, you know, routine.
Yes.
But if you're watching that match, you'll see, think, wow, you know, a couple of points here or there, and that could have been 5-all, and you felt momentum switching and they managed just to hold on. And it looks routine, but it's not routine.
Yeah.
It's very rare that a match doesn't have a crisis or two in it that is the difference between it being routine or an absolute dogfight.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so that was a great insight into your thoughts on the Australian Open. What about French? Was there a, now I'm going to admit that it was so long ago, Dave, that I can't really remember
much French. The French
Open. So you could just make a match up here, and I will not question you on it.
For me, actually, the French, the interesting match was actually the quarterfinal between Alcaraz and Novak. Because I think that showed two things. One, the world that even somebody, you know, who's very young and so accomplished, who's a Grand Slam champion, could get overwhelmed by a situation where there was an expectation that he could challenge Novak and had two very tough sets, and then the body cramped, and that would have been, you know, 90% down to stress levels, mm-hmm. nerves, and, you know, not sleeping probably that well the night before. And I think he admitted it, you know, nerves just overtook him, and then it ended up in him cramping and everything like that. And I think it's just a reminder to all players that are trying to play this game at any level that nerves are part of the game, no matter what level you play.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, even the number one or the number two in the world can have a heavy case of nerves where it destroys their ability to compete on a day.
Yeah.
And, you know, that I think was, I think, good for anybody in tennis to see and then realize how amazing professional tennis players are in the way that they've learned to manage their nerves to produce good tennis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the time, it's very rare for that to happen to a top player, though it does happen. And it just shows you how well they manage their minds to not have this happening all of the time or a lot of the time, which of course with juniors and stuff like that, it does cripple them more often, and they have to learn how to manage their minds so it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that was a fascinating match because the first two sets were very high quality, and then you had the situation develop, which makes people realize that these are human beings, normal human beings, who are doing something extraordinary well. Mm-hmm. And because they do it so well, you never expect the wheels to come off like that, but it can.
Yeah. Which actually I think is what a lot of people would thought. I mean, I'm going way back here, but I think a lot of people thought that about Novak at the 2021 US Open final when Daniil beat him and Novak just couldn't quite get it together. He was emotional, he was crying.
Yeah.
And he was saying, gosh, never seen the guy like that.
Yeah, but I mean, what was at stake was a calendar Grand Slam, and mm-hmm. and that basically overcame him.
Yeah.
And again, showing that everybody's human.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, you know, the reason for all pros to be out here is because you never know what can happen, even to the best of players, if you can put enough stress on them.
Yeah, absolutely.
But and, on the counteractor, how good are these guys, like, you know, obviously Rafa and Roger and Andy and Novak, that for so many years could keep mm-hmm. it together and literally share out all the spoils between them and not have this happen very often, occasionally against each other, but very rarely against lower ranked players. It was a phenomenal period of incredible mental dominance.
Yeah, well, absolutely. When you think about it over the course of a, you know, 15-year period, a 15-year career, for it to only have happened, say, a handful of times,
Well, I think it was less than that. I mean, yeah. I think it was Del Potro. But Del Potro, had he not been injured, I think he would have joined those guys.
I agree, yeah.
And then Stan, obviously, who was able to infiltrate. But, yeah. You know, that's, you know, four slams in 15, 20 years. I mean, it's just quite phenomenal.
Quite incredible, really, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so let's go to the third slam of the year and the final one that's actually been played, Wimbledon. Now, I think I know what match you might pick as a standout match, Dave, but I'm interested to hear what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I mean, I think clearly for me, two matches stand out. Obviously, Liam beating Casper Ruud. But I think the final was, again, a very, very fascinating contest. And I think signaled the real emergence of Alcaraz as, you know, the new guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to beat Novak in a final on a court that he hadn't lost on in 10 years was it kind of reminded me of when McEnroe beat Borg.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously the year before they had that, you know, amazing match and he didn't get over the line. But once he got over the line there, he then became the number one.
Yep.
And I think it, for me, it's very interesting to see if Novak does not win either this US Open or next Australian Open, and either loses to somebody else or Alcaraz beats him in both, then I think you can say that, you know, it's going to be very difficult for Novak after that. But of course, Novak being Novak, he could still win both, you know, and kind of business as usual. And that's why I think it's really fascinating. But having watched the Cincinnati final, which was also a fantastic match, I feel like the balance of power is starting to shift.
Mm-hmm.
But how long is it going to take to be this is the first time I feel like there's a player there that's taking it away rather than, you know,
snatching one match here and there, sort of thing.
Yes. Like, you know, Stan snatched the rat match here and then, and, you know, played unbelievable and everything like that. But you feel like this is a moment where a player is starting to take away the number one ranking.
It's going to be his for a while.
You get that feeling. But you know, who knows? As I said, you don't know how long that's going to take,
mm-hmm.
and whether, you know, there's some young guys, Rune's coming through as well. I mean, you don't know if anybody's going to join that and create another rivalry. But that's what makes it fabulous right now, because I think there are some young guys coming through who really believe that they can join this two-man show.
Good for them. So let's talk about Liam and Casper, who you mentioned there. That match at Wimbledon was absolutely incredible, and I would urge anyone who's not watched it, and if you haven't watched it, you've been under a rock. But if you haven't watched it, go and find the highlights at least, or try and watch the full match, because it was just incredible. How did you and Liam prepare for that match? There was a bit of a, with the weather at Wimbledon, the day that you thought you were going to play, you didn't play, so there was that delay of a day. Does that disrupt your preparation almost in how you go about things?
It definitely, you know, disrupts, but I think because he had gotten through the first round fairly comfortably, he was feeling very relaxed and good about his game. You know, the first round is always a little dangerous. Well, it's very dangerous. And the fact that, you know, he had come off Eastbourne, having played a really good match against Chuinsky, but a kind of slightly disappointing match against Emer. But Emer had played very well as well. But he wasn't really able to get his teeth into that match. Mm-hmm. So coming into Wimbledon, you know, I felt, you know, he was hitting the ball well and in a pretty good place. Mm-hmm. But until he got through that first round, I didn't really know for sure. But once he played a very solid and good first round, and conditions were tricky, a bit windy, you know, the cloud would come over, and then, you know, it was not the easiest conditions. I felt that he was going to perform. I knew he was going to play well. What I didn't know, and where I think the weather also helped, is that I don't think if he had played on the day that he was meant to play, he would have played center court.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the fact that he was on center court, I think I knew he was going to play well. As I said, what I didn't know is exactly how good Casper would be, you know, because I knew that Liam had played a very good match against Medvedev earlier in the year in Doha. And whilst that match was 3-4, Liam had chances to really, you know, he was up a break and had chances to make it really awkward for Medvedev and played a very high level there. So I knew that that was in him. And if he brought that to the court, which I felt he was going to, I was curious to find out how Casper would deal with it and, mm-hmm. and how good Casper would be in that situation, which was the unknown factor. You know, very quickly it became evident that this was going to be a battle.
Yeah.
And then in some ways, you know, you relax because you know it's going to be a battle, mm-hmm. but you also obviously have periods in that match where you know it's touch and go, and, you know, got to hold serve here, or, come on, if you can just break here, you know.
Yeah.
So you have these moments of crisis that you're just hoping that something will happen that goes your way. But I think the level that Liam was able to put out there, and then in the fifth set to really run away with it,
phenomenal
tennis, is an indication of what's in Liam.
Yeah.
If he can really relax like that and find that level of looseness, you know, and relentlessness, which he has found in pieces all the time and in different matches. Like I said, against Medvedev was very good, but there he missed a couple of points that were there really for him, mm-hmm. and that made the difference. Whereas I think he learned from that experience, and in the big moments, was just that little bit more solid. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, you have a lot of disappointment in tennis, and to have a moment like that is what makes it worth it.
Yeah,
you know, there's kind of like 80% disappointment, 20%. I mean, unless you Novak or Alcaraz or, you know, one of the big, you know, Murray or whatever, you know, even they have, of course, disappointments and a lot of disappointment, you know, but at a lower level, there's a huge amount of disappointment. And these moments are actually quite precious.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you really need to savor them. Unfortunately, he didn't get much time to savor it at all because, I was a little disappointed in the scheduling, that given that Wimbledon had the extra Sunday, that he didn't have a day between that and playing Shapovalov, because he, you know, by the time he had done media and everything like that, he only got out of Wimbledon about 8:15 in the evening. Mm-hmm. And to be back on court sort of 1:30-ish. The next day was very little time to very little time to decompress. And physically, of course, also very difficult. And then he still served for the third set and had chances to win that match. But I think it, you know, a day in between would have been very, very helpful. But you know, it is what it is.
I mean, I as you know, I was at that match against Ruud, and I don't think there was a single person on centre court who wasn't screaming at the top of their lungs for Liam at the start of that fifth set when he won the fourth set. And we knew game on. I mean, when he won the first set, I was like, brilliant, brilliant. Liam's going to do me a favour here. He's going to wrap this up in three. It's going to be nice and tidy. I'll get to this. I'll get to see Andy, because you know, I messaged you afterwards, and I had to leave Andy's match to go and get my train back to Scotland. So Liam's going to do me a solid here, and then Casper took the second. I was like, it's okay, we're going to go to four, and Casper took the third. And I went, oh God, we're going to five. But when Liam won that fourth set, there wasn't. I couldn't even hear myself think, because it was just the noise, and I wonder. I actually said to the woman who was sitting next to me, I'm really going to need Liam to bagel Casper here if I've got any chance of watching Andy Murray on centre court at all this evening. And he heard me, he did it. But I often wonder, with that fifth set, was it part of the crowd as well that just really feed him up? And he just, did he think, I mean, these guys are just screaming for me, let's just go for it?
I mean, I think the momentum was so huge coming into that set that it was really, really difficult for Casper, because the noise and the fact that the adrenaline, everything, and the flow that Liam had found made it really, really difficult for Casper. Yeah.
He looked like he was really enjoying himself as well in that fifth set, I thought.
Yes, because he was in the zone. I mean, he was just there and playing, you know, brilliant tennis, totally relaxed, everything, you know, feeling the ball incredible. Whatever he wanted to do with the ball, he pretty much could do. It was a very, very good set of tennis. Probably the best set of tennis he has played in his career. Peter is here. I don't know if he wants to ask any questions, but maybe he's not. I don't know.
He's gone. No. Okay. Unfortunately, This is what happens when you're trying to record a podcast on the road. I think he's actually driving back to Texas as we speak. He does send his apologies, Dave. He'll try and get you another time. Okay, so now let's talk about the US Open. Obviously you're currently prepping Liam for qualies, which for him start tomorrow. What sort of work goes into the preparation with your player for a slam? Is there a big difference between preparing for a slam and preparing for other tournaments or qualifications for other tournaments? What do you do? Is there like mindfulness involved as well?
I think the first thing is, generally coming into a slam, you've got a little bit more time. So you can really get your teeth into the venue, get really comfortable. Also, now Liam has played, you know, these slams a number of times, so we know the venues really well. It's a very comfortable to get into a routine. So that is helpful, you know, that familiarity of the venue and what you need to do in order to get ready. In terms of a difference in preparation, I think for a slam, you know, certainly you know, Kieran here, the physical trainer, is always there for, you know, the slams and maybe a couple of lead up tournaments. So in terms of the physical preparation, I would say that it's sharper than tournaments where you don't have a physical trainer there. And that's nothing to do with the player. None of us can be as sharp with, you know, our physical trainer or even our tennis. If you don't have a coach with you, you don't have a trainer with you. So I would say that side of it is just ramped up a little bit, and just the focus that goes into all of that work is on a slightly different level. And I think that surprisingly, because you got a little bit more time until sort of the day before the tournament starts, like today is a little different because the a little bit of the nerves are starting to kick in. You want the practice to go pretty well, and you know, I have to say this morning it was fine, but it wasn't great. Mm-hmm. And then we went and did a little bit of work after that just to kind of clear the head and just get a really good feel of the ball again. And I feel like Liam left the center feeling, you know, pretty good and in a good space. So I'd say the day before a slam is a little bit more nervy usually than another tournament. But I'd say the preparation is also on a slightly more focused level.
Yep.
And I've just got a message through that he's third match on after 11 tomorrow. So it's going to be about 3 hours, about two-ish, 2:30 tomorrow, depending on how.
Yeah, so it's half past seven UK time.
Yeah, 7:30. Yeah. Maybe 8 o'clock if a match goes long for him.
That's good. I'll need to try and find out somewhere that we can watch this. I don't know if they often stream the qualies.
I don't know. I mean, maybe sometimes a betting site does. I don't know.
Possibly, yeah.
But I don't know if there's, you know, and I do think tennis maybe is missing a trick here. I don't know if you can sell TV rights or whatever for qualies, but mm-hmm. you would think they could do, because there's some incredible tennis that goes on in qualifying.
Absolutely. Do you have a preference, Dave, over, so obviously Liam got a wild card for Wimbledon and he's playing qualies for the US Open. And he played qualies for Australia as well, I believe. Do you have a preference over whether your player gets, because obviously the qualies can give you that, get you the match practice under your belt, it could get you on a winning streak. Wildcard obviously takes away the worry of qualifications, gets you straight into the main draw. Do you have a preference?
Yeah, main draw every day of the week. I think I'm
never sure what people would prefer, if they prefer to get the matches under their belt or not.
No, I think you know, tennis is too dangerous. You know, I mean, obviously this is the only slam that Liam hasn't qualified for.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it would be just a really fantastic moment if he qualified here. Because if he qualifies here, A, it's the first time he's qualified for US, but B, that the points that he would get from qualifying here would take him into the top 100.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be like a double bonus and a fantastic moment for his career all round. You know,
mm-hmm.
playing this as a slam in the main draw for the first time, having tried many, many times, and of course, cracking the top 100, it's just, you know, a nice little fairy tale, but I don't want to say fairy tale in that it's you know, something that's impossible to happen. Fairy tale in that it would just be a lovely coming together, given that he also made the finals here as a junior.
Yep.
You know, so it is a venue that you know, it'd be a nice little circle to come together. But one thing I know about tennis is tennis doesn't care about sentimentality or anything like that. It's a brutal, brutal sport. So, yeah, I don't, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. But he's definitely, you know, one of the better players in the draw.
Well, he's seeded 10th, isn't he?
10th, yes.
Yeah. That's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, but at the end of the day, you know, first round, let's get through that.
Yeah. Let's not. I won't get carried away until until I see him in that main draw.
Yeah.
So he's currently sitting, is it 107? Is that his rank? Currently
yeah,
a career high of 107.
Yeah.
Is it 108? Yeah. Is it you?
I think it's 108, but I think on live rankings is 107. But
okay, maybe that's
as of I mean next week, I mean, who knows, depending on the points, but yeah, at the moment he's 108 officially.
So would you say that's for the rest of the season, you know, from now until the end of November, would you say your kind of main aspiration for Liam now would be to see him crack that top 100?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've got all my fingers crossed for him. I think, you know.
I mean, the good thing is he actually hurt himself last year during the hard court season. And yeah, he had a bit of a stomach strain, and so he actually after the US Open didn't play for 6 weeks. So he has a gap now where he's not defending any points. So you know, from now till the end of the year he's not defending a huge amount of points. So it's wide open for him to accomplish it, but I'd like to do it here.
It would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
well, I believe he can do it, and I believe he deserves it so much. So the keeper.
I mean, he's beaten so many top 100 players. It's not a level issue.
Exactly, it's he has the ability to do it. Yes,
I've said to him for years now. You know, when you make top 100, nobody's going to be surprised. A few people might say, what the hell took you so long? but yes. So I think, you know, you can never be certain of anything, but I'd say that, you know, this is his moment, you know, not just this year is his moment to step through and accomplish something that, you know, every tennis player would dream to do.
Well, I think he can do it. I think we'll be seeing, hopefully I'm not getting too carried away with myself, but I think we'll be seeing him in the top 100 and destined for a good year next year. That'll be my hope for Liam.
Yes, well, I mean, certainly we've been working together a long time, and it would be really nice to go into a year knowing that you're going to play the slams on right. And I think that's another fantastic achievement, to know that you don't have to qualify for a slam, you don't need a wild card, that you are there as part of the tour. And I think that's a phenomenal achievement in itself.
Absolutely. And if there's a player out there, in my view anyway, if there's a player out there that deserves it, it's Liam. I've been watching him for years. I've seen how he's, you can see how hard he works. You can hear how hard he works from chatting to you. So, and I got to see you driving him into the ground at Queen's during his practice in that heat. So I know you don't go easy on him, Dave.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's a very tough sport. So you can't pretend that you can come from a very soft environment and survive in a tough environment. And, you know, you've got to do the hard stuff in order to survive in a hard environment. And and you know, if you don't, you know, create the conditions that allows a player to survive in the environment, then you're not actually doing your job. And hard is not nasty. Hard is just doing the right things over and over again.
Yep.
With, you know, discipline and focus to get where you want to get to.
Yep. Well, absolutely. And I don't think anyone could ever call you nasty at all, Dave. Absolutely not. And I think that's the perfect time to wrap up. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me again.
To join us. And so
continue
Liam's
your good work.
Thank you. Continue your good work, Liam. And Liam's playing tomorrow around 2:30-ish US time. So hopefully about 7:30 UK. If you get the chance to tune in, please do cheer him on. I certainly will be cheering them on, Dave. Best of luck.
Yeah, I don't know if Amazon Prime are showing qualies or not. I mean, UK.
If I can find it, I'll post it to the Money Musings account and we'll
fabulous.
Get people watching them as possible. But best of luck to Liam. Best of luck to you, Dave. I hope you have a really great tournament. And thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks
for
very
listening,
much.
Everyone. Take care.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.